Hi again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Friday, the 14th of December. We're going to have some fun this hour, and maybe you'll all sign up for a Latin class after the hour, or not. The author of Carpe Diem, Put a Little Latin in Your Life, is our guest. You may have seen a piece. Actually, it was one of those moments. I saw a piece in the New York Times on the 3rd of December, I believe it was, and Rhonda and I were talking about our guest's writing in the New York Times that day that dealt with Latin. It was titled A Vote for Latin, and lo and behold, his book happened to be on Rhonda's desk at the same time, and it just, you know, things like that happen. So we booked him for a program, and he also wrote this piece you may want to look up, which is very good, December 3rd, New York Times, on Latin. And he read classics at Oxford. Harry Mount is his name, by the way, and was a Latin tutor before becoming a journalist. He's been an editorial writer and a New York correspondent at the Daily Telegraph. He says, at first glance, it doesn't seem tragic that our leaders don't study Latin anymore, but it's no coincidence that the professionalization of politics, which encourages budding politicians to think of education as mere career preparation, has occurred during an age of weak rhetoric, shifting moral values, clumsy grammar, and a terror of historical references and eternal values that the Romans could teach us a thing or two about. Some of you, I'm sure, did study Latin. It's amazing. It's experiencing a renaissance here. These figures are interesting. In 1905, 56% of American high school students studied Latin. By 1977, a mere 6,000 students took the National Latin Exam. But recently, a signs of revival. In 2005, the number had shot up to 134,873. A good thing? Our guest says yes. Maybe you'll say no. I can't speak Latin, but let's talk about Latin. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. If you'd like to join us by email, then just send us a note at talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Hi, Harry.
Hey, how are you?
Good. How are you?
Great, thanks. Thanks for having me on the program.
Oh, our pleasure. We're going to have some fun. So when did you learn Latin? Did you study when you were a young guy?
I did, yeah. I went to a traditional English prep school in London. So I started around the age of 9.
Mm-hmm. And you studied for how long, Harry?
Until the age of 21, so till university. Yeah.
And tell me what happened from 1905. I cited the statistics you cite.
Yeah.
We had all these people taking Latin, and then it became just a few people like you in prep schools who were learning it. Now a resurgence. Why did we drop it?
Well, I think it certainly happened over here in England, where I'm talking from, and I think it was to do with the 60s generally, and the idea of anything ancient being considered therefore useless, which I think is a wrong equation to make. But it happened over here, happened in the States in the 60s was when the real collapse happened, and that's why by the time you hit 77 there were those 6,000 students taking the National Latin Exam.
Hmm. Anything ancient was anybody over 30 back in the 60s, I recall.
Right, exactly, yeah.
Yeah,
exactly.
So if we're talking Latin.
So if you're talking 2,000 years, yeah, you're already over the hill.
Yeah. You talk in the New York Times piece about the founding fathers, and if we look at them, we have to realize how important Latin was in their lives, particularly somebody like Thomas Jefferson. Tell me about Thomas Jefferson.
That's right. He was absolutely obsessed with Latin and Greek, and he actually, like me, started learning Latin and Greek at the age of 9 at a school in Virginia just down the road from Monticello, where in fact I've just been because I came over for my book launch, and I had a wonderful time. And I saw in the library there, in Thomas Jefferson's library in Monticello, there used to be 7,000 there, but most of them are now in the Library of Congress. But there are a couple of dozen still there, and the most well thumbed is a copy of Virgil's Aeneid. And as I say, he's obsessed with Latin and Greek, and Tacitus and Homer were his favorite writers. And he thought that Latin and Greek should be the center of a high school and a university education. And so when he opened the University of Virginia just down the road in Charlottesville, he employed only classically trained professors. And of course, as your listeners will know, that wonderful university is built on strictly classical principles.
Yeah. And there's a copy of the Aeneid under glass, thumbed through quite heavily. Obviously, spent a lot of time reading it.
Exactly.
What difference does it make? Read the Aeneid in English, read it in Latin.
Well, I think wonderful to read it in English, but it's even better in Latin because that was obviously the language it was written in. And it we get used to the idea that Latin is a bit of a slow, stodgy language when we speak it in our stumbling ways now. But actually, you know, people talked about being in love in Latin and they, you know, who was going to win in the 330 in the Circus Maximus, was it going to be Ben-Hur? They talked about everything in Latin. And actually, I think it was much closer, really, to modern Italian. And I've just been to a conference in Rimini on the east coast of Italy, and there was a fantastic Italian professor in classics from the University of Bologna, and he read out some Horace, and when he read it, it was like a sort of, Italian boy chatting up Sophia Loren in Naples in the 1950s. You know, he spoke it very rat-a-tat-tat and very romantically and quickly, just like we the impressions we get when we hear Italian. And so that's the main reason, is just it's that much more beautiful in Latin.
Spend some time on this. A glimpse into the past, Latin gives us, that provides a fuller, richer view of the present. There's a lot in that. Take it on.
Sure. Well, I think I also use, I used to like to think of, if you know Latin, it's like wearing X-ray specs. You begin to see so much more around you, both in Britain and America. I'm particularly struck in America. As you said in your kind introduction, I was in New York for a couple of years and traveled a lot around the States. And in a way, I think it's an even more classically based place than here in England. If you go to Washington, basically it still seems an imperial city. And it was Jefferson, of course, who insisted that all the federal buildings there should be built on classical grounds. And if you know a little Latin, then you'll know that the same sort of basis lies at the root of the English language. And if you know that root, it makes it tremendous fun learning the derivation of words, but also it's particularly enjoyable working out how those words have changed. So, example, the word candid comes from candidus, meaning white, pure, unvarnished. That makes pretty good sense, but it's a bit more of a leap to work out why candidate comes from candidus. It's a long time since I've heard the word candidates in the same sentence as the words white, pure, and unvarnished. And it turns out that it's because when senators were standing for election in Rome, they didn't go to Iowa and appear on the TV a lot, but what they did do is they sprinkled themselves with white chalk dust.
Oh, my.
So that they could stand out among the crowd, and they'd say, you know, I'll vote for that guy. And so they became known as the candid one, thus the candidate. And so things like that, even though actually it's, you know, it's a big jump, it's so fascinating to learn that journey of that word.
Yeah. And tell us the journey of another word, or flowers. What's the story with the flowers found in the Colosseum, I believe?
Yeah, well, that was, I was on holiday and I met, in Italy, in fact, and I met a botanist from Cambridge University, and we had a drink, and he told me that a few years ago, he'd been there, he'd been to the Colosseum for the first time, and he'd seen these unusual flowers that he hadn't seen before growing in the arena, which, another interesting word, actually comes from the Latin arena, meaning sand, and it's actually the sand which provides the word, the sand in the arena, which came to mean arena, if you see what I mean. Anyway, he saw these flowers growing, and he thought, these are pretty strange, I haven't seen these elsewhere in Italy, and he went up in the steps of the Colosseum, couldn't see the flowers there, went outside the building, couldn't see any of the flowers there, went over the hill to the Circus Maximus, couldn't find any flowers to match these ones he'd seen in the arena and the Colosseum, so he took the flowers back to his laboratory in Cambridge, and he worked out that the only other place in the world that these flowers grew in was in Libya and Tunisia in North Africa. And the only possible explanation he could come up for was that seeds from Libya and Tunisia had got lodged in the hides of the wild animals that were taken from North Africa to fight and sadly devour Christians in the Colosseum. It's a couple of thousand years before, and in having this mortal struggle, they shook off the seeds, and they're blooming today. And I thought that was a terrific analogy for Latin, the language of Latin, that here was a subject we thought was dead, and it's called, obviously, the dead language, but it is, as you said in the introduction, blooming all over the place, and I thought it was a very moving story.
Mm-hmm. What about Greek? If you're going to learn Latin, doesn't it make sense to learn Greek?
Well, it does, but it's one step harder because it's obviously in a different script, and so I very much encourage people to learn Greek. It's in many ways more beautiful, and
really?
In fact, so many of the great things that the Romans did, they acknowledged were based on Greek inventions. In fact, Quintilian, the Roman writer, said he acknowledged that the Greeks had come up with tragedy and comedy and poetry, and he said the only thing we Romans have invented in the literary world is satire. Satire is ours. So Greek, and being that much earlier, is in any ways a more beautiful and influential language, but it's a tricky one with a different script. So I'd advise any listeners keen on classics to begin with Latin, then move to Greek, and they're both tremendously rewarding.
Of the 40 presidents since Jefferson, you write, 31 have studied Latin, many at a high level. Has it made any difference in terms of how they have governed the country?
That's a tricky one, because actually, as I say, Nixon was a terrific Latin student.
In fact,
he came second in his class in Whittier High School in California in 1930. So I wouldn't, it's tricky to make a complete equation between learning Latin and being a virtuous leader. But at the same time, I do think, as you said in your introduction, that it's very important, not just for presidential candidates, but for all of us to learn subjects which are interesting in their own right and good for our brains and for appreciating the beauty and power and interest of language, and not just for professionalization sake, for the sake of jobs. So I thought it was a bit depressing that Hillary Clinton, Rudy Giuliani, and Barack Obama all studied political science at university, and I think in order to become a politician, you shouldn't be really planning to be one at the age of 18. You know, that's the time to learn beautiful and interesting things which aren't necessarily designed to be pragmatic.
Right. Let's talk about what you just said here, it being good for our brains. I've heard that about Latin. Why? What do you mean it's good for our brains to learn Latin?
Well, I think it's funny. A lot of people say learn Latin because it's very similar to English. And as I've just said, it's very useful for working out the basis of lots of words. But actually, the reason I think why it's so terrifically good for your English and also, as you asked, for your brain is precisely because it's so difficult. So different from English. And it's in working out the changes from one to the other, you really get to properly think about how language is formed. And so there are all sorts of grammatical devices in Latin that just don't exist in English, like any of your readers may, their hearts may plunge on the words ablative absolute or the word gerundive, but these are grammatical constructs that have no equivalent in the English language. And funnily enough, because of that, in jumping from one to the other, you really have, in translating, say, a gerundive or an ablative absolute, which I won't go into at the moment, but you really have to properly crunch the cogs in your brain to make the jump from one to the other. And the other thing I'd say is because Latin is a very, very concise, precise language, that in going from Latin to English, I make the analogy of it being like opening up a concertina, that you're opening up from this very, very precise, sharp, concise language to a more expansive one, which is English. And as a result, there's tremendous room for invention. As when I was in Rimini, I also went via Venice, and I saw a wonderful sundial in a monastery cloisters there. And on the sundial, an old monk had once inscribed these words in Latin, which are horas non numero nisi serenas. And that means literally, I don't count the hours unless they're serene ones. But because of this concertina effect, which allows for so much imagination in translation, I think it's fair enough to say that it also means I only tell the time when the sun's out. And I think it also has a third meaning of along the lines of when I come to die, the only moments that matter will have been the moments when I was at ease. And you could do so many things like that with Latin because of it being concise and precise. And it's terrific for enlarging the imagination mm-hmm. when you're, as it were, opening up the concertina. Mm. Then when you squeeze it shut back from English into Latin, there's an entirely different skill which is helped, which is the precision of your prose, because the very good thing about Latin is the same thing for which is often attacked, which is it being a dead language. Well, right. The fact that it's dead means that there's no wriggle room. You know, if you're translating from English to French, there's a terrific room for not only the use of English words in French, they use a lot of, but also a sort of franglais, or as I went to Germany recently, and there they have a thing called Denglish, I'd never heard of, which is a mixture of German or Deutsch plus English, and there are halfway house words, and there's tremendous room, as I say, for a sort of compromise, whereas because Latin is dead, there's no room really to start inventing words there, so you really have to get it bang on the money. So you develop these two skills, imagination on opening up the concertina and precise prose style and understanding of grammar when you squeeze it shut again.
Phone calls. We'll take in a moment. We're talking with the author of Carpe Diem, Put a Little Latin in Your Life. Harry Mount is our guest. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. If you'd like to send us an email, it's talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Harry Mount is our guest. He read classics at Oxford. He was a Latin tutor before becoming a journalist. He's been an editorial writer and New York correspondent at the Daily Telegraph. And we're talking about his new book, Carpe Diem, Put a Little Latin in Your Life. Let's start our calls with Kate from Nina. Hi, Kate.
Good morning.
Hi.
I'm really happy to hear about the book. I was a student in high school. I had Latin in Lakewood, Ohio. I have felt it has benefited me in so many more ways than I can describe. Certainly back then, I didn't think it was that fun, and I didn't particularly like it. But it helped me through all my other avenues of education and employment. Now, my kids are, I think they're getting a good education, but, you know, when I see them struggle in grammar in English, I just really regret that they didn't have the opportunity to get Latin.
Harry.
Hi, Kate. Yeah, no, I really agree, and I talk to a lot of people who, like you, didn't particularly enjoy it at the time, because I'm not going to lie, it is quite difficult to learn, but I often think it's pretty good to learn difficult things when you're young, but in a way that's when your brain is at its most spongy and absorbent, and that certainly in my case you're more obedient and less likely to sort of be diverted by other things. And I completely agree about the effect it has on one's grammar and one's English. I mean, I was struck by when I used to work at the Daily Telegraph, I would deal with a lot of bright young kids who came to do work experience, and a lot of them had very bad grammar, but you never ever got a single classic student who got what we call over here the Grocer's apostrophe. I don't know if you have it over there, which is the classic error of putting the apostrophe in the wrong case when you in the wrong place. Sorry, when you say, you know, a pound of tomatoes, and they put the apostrophe. Invented apostrophe, put at the end of tomatoes, and it's become known as the Grocer's apostrophe over here. And I've never seen a classic student get a Grocer's apostrophe wrong. And once you get that bird's eye view of the language, I think comes from knowing Latin, you just know exactly how the language works, so it would be crazy to put apostrophe in the wrong place.
Thanks, Kate, unless you had something else.
No, thank you very much for your work.
What makes it difficult to learn, Harry?
I think it's because of, like I was saying earlier on, those differences. So those, the things like the gerundum and the ablative absolute, which particularly to a young kid, it doesn't have any equivalent in English. So it's therefore very difficult to teach. And then there are things that do have an equivalent in English, but we're not taught them. So the different cases of a noun, nominative, vocative, accusative, genitive, dative, and ablative, we have various equivalents, but we're never taught these things, obviously, because we learn English without being taught it in these structured ways. And same goes for verbs and the way they work out. And so it is difficult at first to look at language in this proper, serious way of dividing it up into its rules, which often are the equivalent in, there is an equivalent in English. But once you've got that about cases or gerundives or whatever it might be, as I say, then it clicks into place, and English, to a great degree, clicks into place as well.
Mm. Joan from Kewaunee, hi.
Hi. I'm one of those people who graduated in 1957 from a Western Pennsylvania high school, and I happened to have a wonderful freshman teacher in Latin, and I decided I wanted to be a Latin teacher.
Oh, fantastic.
Well, by the time I got out of high school and started applying for colleges, they had dropped their Latin program.
Mm.
And then soon, all the high schools dropped their Latin program. So I ended up becoming an English major.
Oh.
How interesting. Just out of interest, could you point to a precise year when they dropped it? Because as I said off the top of my head, I thought it was the 60s, but would it be, what,
well,
58, 59?
It was 1957 when I graduated. And
right.
When I applied, they said that they were dropping their Latin program.
Right, so it was that
so
year. How interesting.
It would have been... If not the first, like 58 or 59, I would not have been able to complete a program.
Hmm.
How fascinating. Do you think that was the same across the states? Was it a nationwide thing?
Well,
that
I'm not sure of, because I just applied in the Pennsylvania area, but it was definitely true.
How fascinating. And what do you think the reasons were? Was it because,
because
of a sort of fashionable dislike for the past? Or?
Well, I think really they thought that too few students were taking it in.
Right.
In high school, and then it was of no use or no value. But I found when I took Latin that I really came to understand the structure of the English language. It helped me understand cases. And, of course, the fact that so many words come from Latin, it's amazing what it does for you all your life.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, definitely. I think the other thing is that, funny enough, once you know the rules of English inside out, having had this precise training, it doesn't make your English precise. Actually, it makes you much more easygoing and much better flowing English prose style, because like a good footballer who knows the rules inside out or knows how to play beautifully, then he can do more tricks and more invention. Whereas I often see journalists who don't really know the rules of English who try and write in a nice, chatty, engaging style, and they can't do it because they haven't got the basic rules at the back of their mind, so they don't know what they're breaking and what they're following, if you see what I mean.
Yes. Thanks, Joan, so much for your call. Chris from Glendale, hi.
I lived through all of the Apollo lunar missions, and my first exposure to Latin was as a young lad looking at the mission patch for the third manned lunar mission, the third landing mission, and that mission was Apollo 13. Each of these missions had an illustration called a mission patch, which today would probably be called a logo. And on the Apollo 13 mission patch were three Latin words. I'm probably going to pronounce this wrong.
Sure.
But it'd be ex luna scientia.
Right.
And I assume that means science from the moon or science to the moon.
Science from the moon, but actually... Scientia originally meant knowledge, so it would be knowledge from the moon, and then came to be obviously developed into the word science.
Hmm.
I thought that added some class to the mission. It's too bad that was the ill-fated mission that failed to land, but here the mission patch was not entirely modern and not entirely 20th century.
Hmm.
So thank you.
Thank you. Thanks so much for your call.
Yeah, how interesting. And I do think... it does give a tremendous emanation of ancientness and grandness, Latin. I write in my book about how many celebrities now are keen to get hold of that ancientness and grandness by having tattoos in Latin. So Angelina Jolie has this tattoo on the lower slopes of her belly, which reads, "Quod me nutrit, me destruit," which means, "What nourishes me destroys me," which is kind of philosophical thought, and they don't know where that came from. It was John Donne quoted it in the end of the 16th century, so it's been around for a while, but it does give a sort of greater power having that on her belly than if she wrote, "Just what nourishes me destroys me." And it always strikes me how when people call themselves after their fathers. You know, David Rockefeller the second or the 14th or whatever it might be. They always used Roman numerals, not Arabic numerals, and I'm sure that's because it gives a greater feeling of ancientness and grandeur. Mm.
There'd be a difference if we talked about Super Bowl 43.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Do you have a tattoo, Harry?
I don't know, not yet. But if I did, I might well have one in Latin. I mean, you know, it's, what would I have? I don't know. I'd have. I've got a favorite line from the Aeneid, which is. I'm trying to remember it now. Olim haec meminisse etiam juva bit, which is what Aeneas in Aeneid is the man who leaves Troy to found Rome, and his ship is shipwrecked, and he loses all his men, most of his men, and all his ships, and he's sitting on the coast of Italy, absolutely desperate, and his best friend, Achates, an optimistic, jolly man, says this to him, says, Olim me meminisse haec etiam juva bit, and it means one day it'll help to remember these things, or one day we'll laugh to remember these things. And I remember reading that when I was about, I suppose, 13 or 14, and thinking, God, how true it is. And I think of it now that, you know, things are going badly. It's very rare that they're as bad in a year's time or 5 years' time or certainly a decade's time. And there are so many things that one naturally thinks, and you realize the Romans got there first.
Let's go to Bob, it is, from Stevens Point. Hi, Bob.
Good morning. My background with this thing is in 1970, I graduated from a minor high school Catholic seminary. And initially, I liked the sound of it as an altar boy. I never knew what any of the words meant.
Right, yeah.
I always thought it was kind of musical. We just kind of, I think, kind of threw our heads down by the altar and kind of made it up. But
right.
But anyway, it took us, you know, as a major course every year in high school. And I got out of going to the seminary after I went to St. Norbert and De Pere. And there was a college course I took, it was something where we were into Cicero. But
yeah.
There's a different pronunciation in Latin where you would pronounce Cicero Kikero. Anyway, yeah. I went to, spent a year in Peru in 72, way back when. I guess dates me a little bit. But
sure.
But certainly what I wanted to say was, in addition to helping to understand English, with the other Romance languages such as Spanish, really helped me with my Spanish. I went on to use it, not currently using it in my career now in sales, but early on, I did some other jobs where, with migrant workers and other things, where it all kind of stemmed back from the Latin. And I thought it was kind of interesting how Latin became a really big part of my life. So it's a neat topic.
Yeah, well, I'm with you on that, Bob. And I was reading something the other day which is fascinating about exactly how Latin turned into first Italian and then later Spanish. And in the, I think it's around about the 11th or 12th century, in Italy, people just started to drop particularly consonants at the end of particular words, and you can completely follow the way Latin morphs into Italian and becomes a, I said it's free-flowing language, Latin, which it is, it becomes even more free-flowing through a sort of laziness, but it's, and it talks about how that then develops into Spanish, and it's absolutely fascinating, that change, and like you say, there's still tremendous similarities, I mean, massive between Latin and Italian, but also between Latin and Spanish, and as you say, all the Romance languages.
Mm-hmm. Do you speak Italian as well, Harry?
I speak sort of restaurant Italian, but I can I can read it because I could read it very much from my Latin because it's so incredibly similar.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Bob, for the call. Buck from Madison. Hi, Buck.
I'd like to give hot news that Finnish radio every night presents the world's news in Latin.
Oh, my gosh.
I think for about half an hour. I bet Finland has more people who can understand spoken Latin than any country in the world.
I'd read that somewhere. I'd also read, you may be able to confirm this, Buck, but there's a guy there who does the translating there who also does a lot of translating of Elvis songs into Latin.
Into
I
Latin.
Can't do Don't Step on My Blue Suede Shoes immediately in Latin. But anyway, he's done them all, I think.
Oh, my gosh.
And I'd like to recommend three books to people who listen. One is R.A. Lafferty, L-A-F-F-E-R-T-Y, The Fall of Rome. And he's got insights into why Romans are so weird and we can't understand them, right? Their virtues and their vices are strange to us. And for people who want to bone up on their Latin, in our public library, we have Latina pro populi, Latin for the people, right? And let's see. The Vatican is now dependent on one man to translate things into good Latin because even cardinals can't read Latin well. So look for a book called All As in Rome. As in Rome. All right?
Is that by a guy called Reggie something? Because there's a father, Reggie,
who
works
Brit,
in the Vatican.
For sure.
Yeah, he's the guy who also, because as you'll know, they have to translate all the official documents
yeah.
into Latin, and
no,
he's
no.
the one who has to invent new Latin words
no, no,
for
no.
things like the television or a computer, or
no,
the
no.
or he's got a particular long word for an ATM. Anyway,
no.
that
his name is Hutchinson.
Right,
when,
right.
When in Rome by Robert J. Hutchinson.
Right. Yeah. So it's yeah. Well, those sound terrific. Yeah.
Yeah, it's an uphill slog just educating cardinals, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I imagine the Pope himself, I'll bet, probably is pretty good at Latin because he's a sort of clever scholar guy, but I can't speak for the rest of them.
Yeah, and who wants the Inquisition doing Latin translations for us, right?
Yes, exactly.
Goodbye.
Thanks, Buck. Always a delight to hear from you. I can't believe Finnish radio does a half-hour news in Latin.
I know, and as I say, there's... Actually, I read a book about Elvis. I'm a bit of an Elvis fan, and this guy went to interview this man. I think he sings his I think what would Wooden Heart would be Cor. I can do it off the top of my head. Would be Cor Ligneus. I think he sang that.
Thanks, Buck, for the call. Mary from Wauwatosa. Hi.
Hi. I have a story that, as far as I'm concerned, Latin is living today. My nephew came to stay with me 4 years ago to attend high school, and we went over to sign him up at Wauwatosa East. And his background, I mean, he really was interested in science, technology, computer stuff, and very diffident in English and history. And he was offered the choice between Latin and Spanish and said, well, I'll take Spanish, of course. And I said, no, think about the Latin, because it'll really help you with your English and your vocabulary, and it's a great foundation. And well, the clincher was when his advisor, who was the football coach, said, lots of guys on the football team take Latin. Oh, okay. So he did, and he absolutely loved it. He took it for 3 years and just enjoyed it thoroughly, got great grades, and... used to come home and try to trip me up because my background is journalism, and I worked in journalism for many, many years. And so he would try to stump me with a vocabulary word, and it didn't usually happen. And he'd say, well, how do you know all those words? And I said, well, reading and my Latin background. I could figure out meanings of words when I read books without necessarily having to go to the dictionary because of the basis. And I said, it also helped me incredibly with my spelling. And how would that be? And I said, well, because if you go back to the verb and it was A-R-E or I-R-E, and then you could figure out in English how that would work. And so he just really thoroughly enjoyed the Latin, though. And he and a good friend of his used to send each other emails in Latin. And even last spring, a friend of mine who's an artist was doing illustrations for a book that was being produced by a Jesuit priest at Marquette University on a history of one of the elderly Jesuits, and she wanted to do the illustration subtitles in Latin. And so she knew Brian really liked Latin, so she asked him if he would participate.
Great.
And write the subtitles.
Huh.
And so with the help of his Latin teacher at Tosa East, they did that, and he was just terribly thrilled to be part of that work. So And now his greatest desire is to go to Rome and see the Colosseum. And
right.
Oh, yeah, he must go. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so I really am so appreciative that WOTUS East High School, one of the few high schools in Wisconsin, I believe, outside of maybe some Catholic ones, that still offers Latin, because I think it's a extremely strong foundation. And as other callers have said, if you travel, it helps you with Spanish, it helps you with French, even a little bit of German.
Mm.
So it's a great foundation.
And I'll bet him having a scientific mind actually helped. Another great thing about Latin, I think, is as well as being a beautiful art subject, a lot of the skills needed to translate are sometimes almost mathematical in the way one splits up sentences, particularly the famous thing of putting the verb at the end of the sentence. It does often produce a sort of, as I say, almost sort of mathematical approach, and so I think it sharpens both sides of the brain.
Yeah, because that's one of his great strengths, is this abstract spatial things, which just eludes me entirely. But in regard to the caller's comment about Finland,
I
read that article too, and I think they said it was because they were sending their news to other European countries, and so few other European countries had a clue as to how to speak the Finnish language, that everybody knew Latin, or somebody in all of these countries had some Latin foundation, so that they could then take the Latin and then translate what was going on in Finland into their own language.
How interesting. And I think listeners will correct me, but that Finnish is one of the few languages which ironically has no Latinate inputted into it at all. It's one of the few non-Indo-European languages.
Oh, that's interesting.
And I had it myself up until I graduated in 1960 from high school, and it was still prevalent, I think, in both the Catholic and public high schools in Wisconsin, and it was still offered at Marquette University.
Hmm.
And would you happen to know when the change happened? Was it soon after then?
I don't, because I don't have children, so
right.
I didn't follow, you know, what was going on in the school system after that.
Right. Well, it looks like you sneaked in just in time, which is great.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Thanks.
Incredible.
Thank you, Mary.
Thank you.
We'll take more phone calls in a moment. We're talking with the author of Carpe Diem, Put a Little Latin in Your Life. Harry Mount is our guest. And our phone number, one line is open right now, is 800-486-8655-227-2050. If you'd like to send an email, you could do that as well. The email address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to your phone calls now. Pat from Prairie du Chien. Hi, Pat.
Hi.
Hi.
It's fascinating. In the early 60s, I was an altar boy. And I had to learn the responses, like, Ecum Spiritu Tuo, blah, blah, blah. But I always thought that the church lost something when they gave up Latin. I know that it's better in English, I think. But was the Latin of the Mass a classical Latin, or was it more of a popular Latin?
Oh, it was, it came in, I can't remember the exact date, but it's around about the 11th or 12th century. I've actually got a book here, I'll see if I can find it. But so it was, you know, it was ancient classical Latin, and in fact, the church is a very great institution in preserving a pure Latin. So while spoken Latin, as I said, changed very gradually into Italian, the church is one of the great institutions, as well as universities and some schools, that kept up a very pure Latin. So the Latin used in the Mass was would have been completely understood by you know, Roman and in 50 BC. And I've got it here that actually the Pope is very keen on Latin, and he's, as I'm sure you'll know, sanctioned greater use of the Latin Mass, which I think is terrific.
And I have two recommendations for books. Last year, my brother gave me the Aeneid that was newly translated. I think the guy's name is Humphreys.
Right.
And since then, I've been reading a fascinating book by a guy named Jerome Carcolpino, Everyday Life in Ancient Rome. It's fascinating.
Oh, yeah. Well, I haven't heard of that first translation. There's a terrific one by Robert Fagel that came out last year.
Right,
I can also recommend, yeah.
Well, thank you much.
Yeah, thanks so much for the call. Marie is next from Appleton. Hi, Marie.
Hi, Kathleen. When we were reading about Dido dying on a barge,
I was watching for case endings, but my friend was sobbing. She really got it.
Where was that? Where were you reading?
In
were
high
you reading
school.
The Aeneid? Were you?
In high school.
Oh, yes.
Yes, and she got the lyricism, which I didn't get.
What were you reading? I didn't hear that.
Aeneid.
Oh, the Aeneid. Okay.
And I was just getting subject, verb,
right.
Object. But she got, you know, the real meaning of the Aeneid that I missed. I was in the nuts and bolts only.
Yes, but as I say, anyone reading the English translation, I think, will be very upset. And anybody who's recently had the misfortune to be chucked, probably the world's most moving story of being chucked is Dido, who's the beautiful woman who Aeneas falls in love with, but he must leave her to go and found Rome. She doesn't think this is a good enough excuse for leaving her, and there's a very, very moving scene of her discovering that he's left her. And it'll appeal to all of us who've ever experienced the tremendous misery of being chucked.
I like that.
I do too. Anything else, Marie?
No. I am enjoying your guest very much, and I always enjoy you. You're 100%.
Thanks, Marie. Not always 100%, but thank you so much. Let's go to Tom from Burlington. Hi, Tom.
My sister and I were outside the Art Institute in Chicago on Michigan Avenue. We were looking up at the top of the cornice on the building there, and it said Michelangelo, Picasso, Raphael, Monet, Da Vinci, Anno Domini. And we got to the Anno Domini, and we couldn't figure out what artist he was. Of course, that's the Latin word for year of our Lord. But
sure.
What I wanted to point out is I studied Latin for 4 years in Jesuit schools, and my favorite books are my Latin books. I love the smell of them. I can go back to when I was a kid in school. And we had to translate Caesar's conquest of Gaul, your home country, your hometown.
Yeah.
But one of the things about English is that English is a Germanic language, and Yankee ingenuity is based on a German logical language. English and German are very logical languages, and English and German differentiate the difference between something before you get to the noun, whereas Latin and Spanish, they describe the thing after the noun. They'll say, the small black green car, and they would do it backwards.
Right.
And the thing is, the language you speak in is the language that you dream in. And you can wake up with English, and you can describe exactly what your dream was. Whereas in, say, the Chinese or Japanese or even with Latin and Spanish, it's a different way of thinking. And the language you use is the language your mind works in.
Mm-hmm. Harry.
I'm sure that's true, yeah. And I was very struck because I was in Germany where my book has come out. I was on a book tour there, and I regrettably can't speak German, but I was talking to some Latin fans there, and they told me that a lot of German verbs, like Latin verbs, go at the end of the sentence too. And so I could ask them what had always been on my mind, which is exactly as you say. It must make you think very differently if you have to wait for the verb at the end of the sentence. You must plan it in your head much more than we do. And actually, they said it, like any language, you get used to it. They said that there was no problem, but as I'm sure, as you say, it must massively vary the way you think, the language you inherit.
Yes, it sure must. Thanks so much for the call, Tom. Jim from West Salem. Hi.
Good morning. A couple of things. The lady that called not too long ago, the football coach, remember,
yeah.
Lombardi was a Latin teacher.
Oh.
Okay.
All right.
All right. Number two.
Do you know
is,
about Vince Lombardi, Harry?
I'm afraid I don't. No, ma'am.
All right. He was a very famous Green Bay Packer football coach. You need to look him up. So
oh,
that's
right. I'll look him on the internet tonight.
Okay.
Yeah.
Exactly. Number two, I'm a product of the 40s. As far as Latin is concerned, we had to have a foreign language. It was a public school, went into public school. And I remember very vividly an experience there in a class when the teacher asked my first cousin, hic, hike, hoke, and he had hic, hike, hoke, ferris, ferris, ferris. He said ferris, ferris, fart. Kicked out of class.
Oh.
Oh, how things have changed. And over the experience, I'm a retired high school administrator, always impressed upon my teachers in loco parentis.
Right,
in
sure.
In place of parent. Isn't that important? I think it is.
Yeah.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I know. Was this in Wisconsin, was it?
Yes. Yep. In the public school in Wisconsin. Yep.
And do you know when they stopped teaching Latin there? Or
I really don't know what it was. It was required as a foreign language. Had to get into college. And I think one of the reasons why we had Latin is we had a Latin teacher. And probably the next teacher came in was maybe a Spanish teacher, and that's why it happened like it did. So we don't have too many Latin classes, I think, in public schools today. In our private schools, I think they still have it.
Hmm. Right, yeah. And actually, I'm struck by how often a school, particularly over here in England, depends on some great figure who is getting on a bit in years, who is the school desperately persuades to stay on. I was at a school in Birmingham, the middle of England, a couple of weeks ago, and there was a very charming man in his late 70s who had tried to retire from the school four times. Each time they said, no, you must stay, no one else can teach Latin. And so I so hope that there's going to be a proper boom so that we then produce more teachers.
Yeah.
Well, I made it. I had two D's.
Right.
But I made it. Okay.
Thanks, Jim. Thanks for the call. It also helps explain why the football players at Wauwatosa were taking Latin, right? Because of Vince Lombardi. There we go. Learning things here today. Lewis is next from Marshfield. Hi, Lewis.
Good morning. Great program. Harry, all I can say is Catholic grade school, Catholic high school, so familiar with Latin.
Right.
But I've been trying to translate something from English into Latin, and I have a problem with it.
Sure, fire away.
And it is just a phrase. It is what it is.
That's a good one. I suppose, literally, it would be est, E-S-T, quad est. So E-S-T, then Q-U-O-D, then E-S-T. But I'm just interesting. That's the great joy about translating, is that so many ways of doing it. Might be just possible just to say quod est, Q-U-O-D-E-S-T, the thing which is. In a way, I like the concision more, so perhaps just to leave it at quod est.
Thank you very much.
Pleasure.
Thank you. Thanks, Lewis. Yeah, thanks. You too. Mandy from Lafarge. Hi.
Hi. First-time caller, so I'm a little nervous. But
sure.
I tuned in late, and I don't know if your guest mentioned so many kids today probably know Latin and don't even know they do from the Harry Potter books. Aren't most of her spells in Latin or some derivative thereof?
That's right. In fact, there's the motto of the school is, someone will correct me because it's on the top of my head, but is don't disturb a sleeping lion, which is a dragon, sorry, which is Draco Dormans. I can't remember. Anyway, certainly the motto is in Latin, and I know J.K. Rowling is studied Latin herself and is a big fan of the language.
Huh.
Yeah, and as far as time of taking Latin, I took 5.5 years, and I graduated in 1977. This was in Chicago suburbs, so it was still being offered at that point.
Oh, right. Was that widespread in Chicago then? Because that was as I say, a low point, I think.
I would think it would have been, at least in the larger schools that had a variety of languages, you know. They usually had a Latin teacher. And shout out to Mrs. Clazura, if you're still out there. She was a wonderful Latin teacher and really made it come alive with history and let us translate rock and roll songs. Things that really were pertinent to kids. So we really enjoyed it.
Yeah. Thanks, Mandy.
Alrighty, thanks.
Yeah. Thank you so much for the call. We have about a minute left. Let's go to Suzanne from Spirit. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi, thank you. Our family thrills to study Latin from the dictionary, the root meaning of words. And here's some that are really interesting. Personality. The dictionary says it means mask worn by the actor in Latin. And hate means ill will. And the devil means slanderer. And evil means up from under. And war means confusion. And maybe you could tell us what love means, because I thought it meant to thrill.
I can't do that, because Latin for love is obviously amor, and so I can't see the connection there between that one, but love. Lovers Amour is one that we all know very well from French, Italian, and in fact our own English Amorous, etc.
Mm-hmm. Thanks so much for the call. Well, Harry, you're on to something, bud.
Well, thanks yeah, aren't so much. You? Great pleasure being on the show.
It was so much fun. I really enjoyed it. Thanks for the book.
Thanks. Have a terrific weekend.
Thanks. You too. Harry Thank Mount. You. The book is Carpe Diem, Put a Little Latin in Your Life. It has just been published, and it is available by Hyperion. And he is he read classics at Oxford, was a Latin tutor before becoming a journalist, and has been an editorial writer and New York correspondent at the Daily Telegraph. For those of you who don't get the book, let me go through my papers here and find out where. December 3rd, he also wrote a very interesting piece in the New York Times. So you can go on the internet if you have one and look at New York Times December 3rd, because he wrote a fairly lengthy piece about presidents and those who learned Latin and those who didn't, and how important it is for understanding our present to have a fuller view of our present to glimpse into this particular past. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, and to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production here in our studios. And thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. Have a lovely weekend. We'll be with you all things political Monday at 9 on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.